Somehow, the holidays are upon us. And if you're like me, you may have made a last-minute capitalistic dash through stores or the internet. And now, exhale. Breathe. We've got a nice show for you. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to Marketplace Weekend, where the economy meets real life. While retailers are evaluating how they've done this season, and many of us are cooking or spending time with family, there's still news out there. Everything from who gives you your healthcare and why it matters, to whether a Christmas tree is real or fake, and man, that matters a lot to the people who grow them, to how you're probably already using digital encryption and don't even know it. As always, come share your thoughts with us on Marketplace.org, our Facebook page, or on Twitter. We're at Marketplace WKND. We're starting off the show, as we do most weeks, with our long and short segment. That's where we borrow some terms from the world of finance. Long as in betting on something, short as in betting against it, and apply it to the news. This week, we've got Marketplace's own Raghu Manavalan and Sabri Benishor. Welcome to you both.
Hi, Lizzie.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. All right. We've got a real mix here, I think, of the serious, the less serious. Sabri, why don't you start us off with your short, actually?
I am short international trade, just generally.
As a concept, as the deals?
So I think in terms of the level of international trade, I think that Donald Trump and his new advisors are very opposed to the trade deficit. In order to get it down, they're going to...
And some Democrats on the left certainly agree with them.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. In order to get that trade deficit down, I think they are going to crimp international trade agreements, levels of trade. I think they will probably throw up some barriers to trade, which will limit a certain amount of incoming goods. You know, whether this restores a trade deficit or improves it, or whether even that is a good goal, I'm staying out of. But I do think it's going to limit the overall level of trade.
Well, this is one of the interesting things, right? Because if you kind of pull out of multilateral trade deals, that then means a lot of, you know, individual or kind of one-on-one negotiations between countries. And that's also obviously going to be kind of happening in Europe over the next 2 years when we think about the aftermath of Brexit.
Yeah, but I think those are not going to expand international trade. I think they are going to replace, and probably to a limited extent. I mean, if it goes so far that we withdraw from the WTO and have to negotiate a bunch of bilateral trade agreements, I mean, I think that's going to throw up a lot of immediate obstacles to trade, just the fact that we have to go through these agreements. But I also think those are not going to expand trade further than what we have now. I think it will shrink it personally.
I think I would also say, I mean, if you're going to just rip out, you know, multilateral agreements like that, that's 4 years. That's a whole presidency, just replacing each individual agreement with, you know, what do you want to do? Where is the time for repealing Obamacare? Where is the time for infrastructure and things like that? I mean, I don't know if it's a talking point or if it's like an actual point of pride, but we'll see.
Well, and one of the things that I think happens to every incoming administration, which I saw covering the Bush administration, covering the Obama administration, the world happens. News events happen. Presidents come in with priorities, and very often those priorities are derailed by big things.
Right, the circumstances of life,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah. The Obama team did not think that the biggest thing they'd be facing at the beginning of their administration was an economic crisis.
Right.
And yet, there it was. All right, I'm turning this car, literally. Yes, I did that. Talk to me, Raghu, about your long.
So I am long self-driving cars, and I'm going to use the phrase long in the traditional sense. It will probably be a long time before we see a return on investment on self-driving cars.
You're long and long.
I am long and long. I'm long on my long. I don't know if you heard, but this week Uber piloted their self-driving car situation technology, whatever. There's a driver in the car with them. But basically what happened was, I don't know if it was the first car or one of the first cars on the road, drove past a red light when there was a pedestrian crossing the road in San Francisco, which
Oof.
Is kind of as bad as it gets. I mean, accidents happen all the time with human drivers across the country. That's fine. But
true.
I mean, for one of your first days on the road, you're going to do something that gets you pretty much immediately disqualified during a DMV test. That's kind of a bad look, right? Mm. I will say, I think this has more to do with Uber itself than the whole self-driving car technology situation. There are a lot of companies getting involved in self-driving cars. I mean, they're not... One of the big deals with this Uber deal was they basically didn't tell anybody. They didn't go through the regular protocols. They didn't get the regulation. They didn't get the licenses. So I want to say this is a bump in the road, to make another bad pun.
Fair.
Another bump in the road for self-driving cars. But I think this is wholly an Uber thing and not so much a self-driving car thing.
So I'm actually going to quote somebody I saw on Twitter because I thought this was kind of funny. They said, like, Grandpa, what was it like before self-driving cars? And the person replying, oh, well, we all just had a lot of accidents then. I mean, I do think that they're, you know, we have to remember that driving and human drivers are dangerous. So as we think through these kind of big questions about the economics of self-driving cars or what that means for people who drive for a living, long-haul truckers, et cetera, there is an argument to be made that self-driving cars are safer.
Yeah, there's also an argument to be made that people love to regulate new technology out of existence before it's ever born.
So, that's a good point.
I mean, I am hopeful that we get them. I mean, for no other reason than if, you know, have you ever been, let's say, 10 cars back at a red light and you see that red light turn green and you have to wait a full minute for everyone's reaction and reflex time to trickle from one car to the next until finally, which is you, and you can go. If we all were in self-driving cars, all of the self-driving cars would just go at the same time and it would be so much more efficient. However, we will never...
And you could probably get your emails done at the same time.
Yeah, I could just be on my phone the whole time.
The dream.
But no, I mean, I have such little faith in people's willingness
to
accept
the future.
It's going to take a
while. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so we're kind of sci-fi, which means, I guess, Sabri, I can't believe you're going to do this on our radio program, but go ahead. Go long.
Well, my long is aliens. I'm long on aliens. We keep on getting
this. This is a show about economics. Go ahead. Yes.
We keep on getting these bizarre radio bursts detected from some galaxy like 3 billion light years away in the constellation Auriga, which I've never heard of. Anyway, it's probably just like a neutron star or something colliding with another neutron star, but it's very puzzling and no one actually can figure out. No one has a good explanation for what these bursts are, so they think that it's aliens or alien TV shows or alien radio shows, and we're just intercepting them.
And you're sure this isn't an elaborate marketing gimmick for Rogue One?
Oh, I didn't think of that. It could be. It could be. I mean, but it's also given all the unexpected things that have happened this year.
It would be the most fitting end to 2016
it would be
ever.
Perfect.
Yeah,
aliens.
Absolutely. Aliens.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. You people are alien to me in this way because, you know, I'm over 40. So tell me about your short, Raghu.
I am short on, I'm not going to use the M word. I'm going to refer to them by their age group. People aged 18 to 34 living at home with their parents still. According, I don't know what you just said.
Right.
40% of that age group lives at home, according to Trulia, which is a 75-year high.
Wow.
We talk a lot about how unemployment is dropping, how, you know, the stock market is hitting almost 20,000, things like that. But we keep talking about this disconnect between the numbers up here and how people are feeling at home. And I think this is a really good example of that kind of situation.
Well, and it also goes to one thing that is, you know, top of mind for a lot of people in that age group, not going to use the M word, but they are indebted. We have seen, you know, this growth in student loan debt. That's
right.
Something we've done a lot of reporting on in this show. When you talk about 42 million people who have student loan debt, often that means you're looking to economize in other places. And, you know, if that means that you save on rent by staying with your parents for a little bit, hey, more power to you.
If I could psychologically handle it, I would love the savings, but I don't think I could do that in my time of my life.
At some point, the savings in rent are going to come up against the expenses of therapy. And when those two things reach a break-even point, I think we'll see people move.
Or, you know, the flip side, which is you have these companies like Pulte and other big home building companies saying, hey, we're actually making multi-generational housing because the sort of two-person nuclear family thing is going away in the way that a lot of sort of building of the American suburb did in some respects. Mm. So you see this in Silicon Valley where the mother-in-law apartment has become a real selling point.
Mm. Right.
Marketplace's Sabri Benishor, Raghu Manavalan, thank you both very much.
Oh, you're so welcome, Lizzie.
Hey, thank you.
No secret that we like to do the numbers here at Marketplace. So we're going to dig into them with our producers, Tony Wagner and Eliza Mills, as they bring us some of this week's news by the numbers. Hit it, Tony.
Thanks, Lizzie. Our first number is
16 billion.
That's how many letters, cards, and packages the U.S. Postal Service will process between Thanksgiving and New Year's.
The week before Christmas is the busiest of the year. 611 million items were mailed on Monday alone.
The New York Times notes the rise of online shopping has been a boon to the Postal Service, but they still have to staff up for the holiday rush. $100,000.
Speaking of online shopping,
that's how much business the Donald Trump campaign store has been doing each day this month.
At least according to Alex Sarp, the 25-year-old store manager who talked with Esquire this week.
She says the best-selling item is, what else? The iconic red Make America Great Again cap.
$250,000.
That's the average cost of an award-winning float at the Rose Bowl Day Parade.
The design, construction, and animation is factored into the cost.
Plus a whole lot of flowers.
Not included? Labor costs. Volunteers decorate most of the floats.
One.
The Christmas Day number one single is a very big deal in the UK.
Oh, I thought Love Actually just made that up.
Nope, it's a thing. And as of this recording, a couple days before Christmas, it looks like the title will go to Rockabye by the pop group Clean Bandit.
Let's go out on a clip.
Call it love and devotion. Call it a mom's adoration. Foundation. A special bond of creation. Ha! For all the single moms out there going through frustration. Clean Bandit. China Ball. And Marie thing made them air.
She works a night. By the water, she's gone astray, so far away from my father's daughter. She just wants her life for a baby.
This week, in an attempt to protect the environmental policies of his administration, President Obama placed an indefinite ban on drilling for fossil fuels in large chunks of the Atlantic and Arctic oceans. The oil industry is looking to President-elect Trump to overturn the order when he takes office. But this is all shaping up to be complicated. Marketplace's Andy Euler joins me now to discuss all of this. Hi, Andy.
Hey, Lizzie.
First, can you explain what this measure does?
So it's a part of a permanent ban, and I think the emphasis on permanent is really important. It's trying to make sure that offshore oil and gas drilling in a big part of the Arctic and also along the Atlantic seaboard isn't going to happen, that new leases aren't going to be issued. It seems to be a really powerful leverage toward protection against the new administration that's going to be coming in. It also seems to me to be more than just sort of a last minute effort, like a pardon or something like that. Obama and Canada's Prime Minister Trudeau have been working on this to develop sort of a framework to prevent quick and sort of mass exploration. And so this seems to be a strong statement toward climate policy that could actually be tangible to people, to certainly environmentalists. And he's also given them sort of an avenue to talk about this. And he's used sort of an obscure provision of a 1953 law that was passed under Eisenhower. It's called the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act. And it actually gives him the authority to act basically unilaterally. And so it's going to make it tougher for any incoming administration to overturn it.
Yeah, I mean, certainly critics of this say, whoa, this is a big overreach. Mm-hmm. So when you look at it that way, is this reversible if you're the incoming administration?
So that's the thing, is that the White House is saying this action is permanent, which is probably a direct response to this incoming administration promising to open more federal land for drilling. Again, like you said, the oil and gas lawyers, they're pretty crafty, and opponents are saying that the president-elect will find a way to overturn it. Now, at the same time, this is really sort of forward-looking because Arctic exploration is really risky, really expensive. Case in point, Shell spent more than $7 billion looking for oil and gas up there, and then they pulled operations last year.
Yeah, they just gave up.
Exactly. And so it's just really risky and really expensive. So this is sort of a when we figure out, because we didn't know about hydraulic fracturing. We didn't know about fracking, you know, 10, 20, 30 years ago, and then it just became sort of standard. So I think this is forward-looking in the sense that we're going to figure out a way to make it easier in the Arctic to drill. And so this is sort of saying when that comes, we need to have these measures in place.
President Obama has also expanded onshore drilling mm-hmm. and expanded some shallow water drilling. You know, this feels a bit like it's a more of a corrective to that if you are thinking like an environmentalist, or a balance to that perhaps when he is trying to solidify his legacy.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think a lot of environmentalists, in fact, thought that the Obama administration was going to be more sort of on their side. And what this is doing, I think, and again, I think this is more than sort of a last minute effort. But at the same time, it is saying, look, this gives environmentalists, this gives you an avenue to look at what's happening, to look at what's going to happen in the future in the Arctic. And it also makes sure that any incoming administration, any incoming overturn or attempt to overturn this is going to play out in the public landscape. It's going to play out in front of the courts. Certainly, if a Republican Congress was to come in and overturn it, that seems really difficult. It doesn't seem like the president-elect can come in and just say, look, I'm going to overturn this. That's why the White House is saying, look, this is permanent.
Andy, Russia has significant interests in drilling and exploring in this area. Does this complicate their plans?
It might complicate what Russia's able to do. You're right. They assume there's a lot of oil and gas up there, and this is uncharted territory. So Russia's probably going to get they're going to have better access with this incoming president, it seems, than they had with the Obama administration. Also, the Secretary of State that President-elect Trump has said is going to come in is a former ExxonMobil CEO. So Obama knows this, and he laid sort of a big marker down saying, look, we're going to make it more difficult for certainly for any sort of American firm to drill up there. But at the same time, he's going to make it more difficult for Russia to do it as well, because that land is so it's so difficult sort of to parse out. And international waters are really difficult to sort of regulate. So anything that the Obama administration can do to say, look, these areas aren't going to get leases. Sure, it makes it more difficult for Russia. It certainly makes it more difficult for any American drilling to happen up there. But yeah, it is going to affect Russia, I think, for sure.
Marketplace's Andy Euler, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Do you prefer a male or a female doctor? Well, research out this week from the journal JAMA Internal Medicine might influence that. The study suggests that elderly hospital patients who were treated by women doctors lived longer than when they were treated by men. That certainly raised eyebrows, since male physicians get paid about $20,000 more on average than their female counterparts. This is the first large-scale study to look at how gender affects what happens to patients. From our health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
Listen to this. Two different doctors talking with two different patients at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. First, here's Dr. Kerry Reynolds.
While we're here, the biggest thing we want to do for you is make sure we've looked through everything.
Yes.
And that we don't leave any stone unturned.
Okay.
Now, listen to Dr. Ryan Thompson.
Let us know if we're not doing a good job.
Yes.
You know, we can always do better.
It's really hard to tell a difference, right? But research says there might be something different between how women and men practice medicine. Elderly patients treated by female physicians have a 5% better chance of living after getting out of the hospital. Put another way, if you were to replace all the male doctors in the study with women, 32,000 fewer people would die a year.
I think the most surprising thing is that we found something. You know, why would gender matter?
That's Dr. Anupam Jenam, one of the study authors. It's surprising in part because there's been a push for equality in the field. And here come these results that threaten to upend that modern ideal with data. The results are based on 1.5 million hospital patients and 58,000 doctors. But even with that, Jenna says they wanted to be sure, so the team checked obvious explanations, like women keeping their patients in the hospital longer, different post-hospital referrals, or just spending more money.
None of those things emerged.
This is the first large study to look at how gender impacts patient outcomes. And one thing to keep in mind, the effect is modest. Dr. Vineet Arora at the University of Chicago breaks down what that means.
The way that you would think about that is if you were hospital administrator and you were to reassign 149 patients to female physicians, then you might see this benefit of one life saved.
That kind of impact may explain why most patients and staff I talked to at Mass General shrugged when I asked if they saw a difference between men and women. What did come up was the difference between good and bad doctors. Patient Tracy Nifford has seen a lot of both. She's been to the hospital 30 times this year with an infection she can't get in front of. Nifford got tired of fighting with doctors over things like sending her home with antibiotics that didn't work.
I was at a point in my life that I said, you know what? I'm done.
With this study, it's easy to get stuck in some war of the sexes debate, but this is about the best way to practice medicine so all physicians can do better by their patients. Nifford says it's enough to be sick and scared. There's no room for doctors to make life harder.
As far as getting this fixed, I didn't know what I would do. I was basically at my ropes, you know, the end of my rope. Couldn't take it anymore.
For Nifford, what matters is doctors who listen, are empathetic, and generous with time. And research suggests women doctors tend to do that better than the men. But Jenna's instinct tells him what's driving this statistical difference is how female physicians tend to approach problems and make decisions. He compares it to how he and his wife would rent a car and a car seat for their toddler.
The way I do that is I Google, find the first thing that comes up, and then I make a decision. She will go through probably 5 to 10 different web pages and look through all the Yelp reviews.
This study is not definitive. It's a thread to pull to better understand the qualities that make up the best doctors. And odds are that means looking more closely at the women than the men. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
Beef. It's what's for dinner.
You know those slogans. How about, it's Christmas, keep it real? That's the slogan from the Christmas Tree Promotion Board, which, like the creators of those other slogans, is a marketing group. And they want people to buy real trees, not the fake plastic ones that are taking over the holiday market. Marketplace's Marielle Segarra has our story.
On a street in New York City, two little girls are standing in front of a 13-foot-tall, fully ornamented Christmas tree when it starts talking.
My name's Fraser. I'm the tree.
Fraser asks if they have a real Christmas tree at home.
What? You don't have a real tree?
Recognize the tree's voice? It's Neil Patrick Harris, who, in this video, is sitting behind a figurative curtain, talking into a microphone, and extolling the virtues of real Christmas trees. It's part of a one-day gig he did for the Christmas Tree Promotion Board, which collects 15 cents for every tree farmers sell. Tim Dunn owns Woods Edge Christmas Tree Farm in New Jersey, a small farm with about 6,000 trees.
So it was $75 or $80 that we had to pay.
Dunn plasters stickers with the campaign slogan, "It's Christmas, keep it real," everywhere.
We have one there on our cashier's table. We have one in the window. Our little utility vehicle outside. I said anything to help stem this trend towards artificial trees.
This year, 81% of the 100 million households putting up a Christmas tree are going artificial, according to a Nielsen poll on behalf of the American Christmas Tree Association. The Christmas Tree Promotion Board's communications director, Marcia Gray, says the group will spend $1.25 million on research and marketing this year.
And that's really not a lot, particularly during the very high-end holiday advertising season.
The dairy board that created the famous Got Milk slogan spends about $145 million a year. The beef board, $41 million. Some Christmas tree farmers think the campaign is a bad idea. Andrew Allpaw owns the 60,000-tree Evergreen Valley Christmas Tree Farm in New Jersey. He paid about $600 to the promotion board last year.
I don't like the idea of somebody taxing me and decide how to spend my money to advertise.
Allpaw says with the farm in between New York City and Philadelphia, he's getting all the business he needs, and that competition from artificial trees isn't an issue.
Families that get a real tree, they get a real tree regardless of whether, and the folks that use an artificial tree, you know, that's what they're going to do.
The Christmas Tree Promotion Board says it wants to hook young families on real trees. They say it's like planting seeds. In New York, I'm Marielle Segarra for Marketplace.
Mm-hmm.
of us, the holidays center around food. It's a way to bring people together. So whether you're frying latkes or serving up a Christmas ham, or like my mother, making curry for about 20 people, I bet you have a few of your own food traditions. And chefs do too, with their families. We spoke to two Los Angeles chefs about their favorite holiday foods. And I'm going to let them introduce themselves.
I'm Steve Sampson, chef of Soto Restaurant and the upcoming Rosso Blu in Los Angeles.
I'm Ray Garcia, chef owner of Broken Spanish and BS Taqueria.
I've been interested in food my whole life. My mom is from Italy, in Bologna. I used to go to Bologna to stay with my grandparents almost every summer. Life in Italy kind of tends to revolve around the table.
I studied political science and business economics. I graduated, but the whole time when I was reading my college textbooks, I was also flipping through Cooking for Dummies and the Better Homes and Garden cookbook.
I kind of floated around for a while without knowing what I wanted to do with my life. I was actually going to go to medical school, and then I decided I was going to go to cooking school instead. The second I got into a kitchen, though, I just realized it was what I wanted to do.
For me, some of the traditional comfort foods around the holidays were tamales, ham, beans, rice, tortillas.
Tortellini and brodo is kind of the most famous one. It's kind of the special occasion dish. They're little tiny tortellini that you eat in broth, and they're hard to make because they're so small. They're very labor-intensive. So just because of that, they tend to be more of a special occasion dish, and every major holiday includes tortellini for sure.
Tamales are something that I enjoyed eating. I love to make around the holidays, and I serve at my restaurant now. I have a vegetarian version that kind of rotates seasonally, so right now it's a parsnip and chestnut tamal with a little splash of mezcal. There was not mezcal at the house, at least not for me when I was growing up and making tamales.
I've kind of taken over a lot of the duties for holiday meals because I don't want my mom to have to work. And now the family's big, it's like 20 people, but she still makes the tortellini. That's one thing I haven't taken, but usually I'll make the roast. In Italy, there's also traditions around New Year's Eve that are very symbolic, like lentils and cotechino. Lentils symbolize little coins, so that means it symbolizes prosperity. Cotechino is a very hearty sausage from Emilia-Romagna, and in L.A. it might not make too much sense, but in northern Italy it gets pretty cold during the winter, so they generally eat the cotechino with lentils and mashed potatoes. That's kind of the New Year's Eve dish.
I have a three-year-old son, and I'd love to find some sort of way to start incorporating him in the cooking process like I was when I was younger, whether we make our own tamales or whether it's a cookie recipe that we can all kind of get our hands dirty with and make and share around the table.
Obviously, it can be intimidating to cook for a lot of people, but if you just plan ahead and get as much done ahead of time, I would like to do a whole roast, more family-style stuff, so you don't have to sit there and plate for too many people. Like the roast, you kind of just slice it and serve it, and people serve themselves. A big roast like that, you can definitely cook it ahead of time and then just reheat it right before.
I think that you can make a great holiday meal on a budget. If you're having people over, incorporate them in the process, and you don't have to necessarily buy all the pies or the breads or the cookies or the baked goods. Give it a shot and try to make a bread together. Try to make the mashed potatoes. And the more that you can make from scratch, you know, not only is it going to be a little bit more and affordable, but it's going to be a memory for you and everyone who participated.
Pasta is always very cost effective. You know, they say Italian restaurants always have good food cost percentages because it's all flour and water, they say. So pasta dishes are usually very cost effective. You know, like a lasagna, something like that can be kind of labor intensive. But again, it's all stuff you get ready ahead of time. So then you just throw it in the oven. If it's a braised cut of meat, the braising cuts, sort of like a pork shoulder or a beef shank or something like that, they're usually much more cost effective than, you know, a prime rib. And they're super delicious if you just cook them right.
Thank you.
digital encryption can sound like one of those things only the pros do, or that belongs in the world of spies. But encryption is increasingly a big part of our daily lives. This week, Marketplace's Codebreaker podcast is exploring the world of encryption and why more and more of us are using it. Here's Codebreaker host Ben Brock Johnson.
A day in the life of encryption starts when a day in my life starts. Encryption happens in bed while I am checking my messages on WhatsApp, because my buddy in Singapore sends me messages while I am sleeping.
Usually I just look at my phone and read and pet my cat.
Then I get out of bed.
I think I'm going to check my Gmail.
Encryption.
I need a new water bottle, so I'm going to go on Amazon, put it in my shopping cart.
Encryption.
I'm going to stop at the ATM and get some cash.
Encryption. Get in a cab, pay, encryption. All day, every day. Sending things over the internet, communicating with friends, taking money out of the bank, buying goods, paying for services. None of this is possible without encryption. It's all around us. But do we really understand how it works and why it matters? Let's start with some basics with help from Susan Landau.
Well, we all use it and know it from being small children. We try to hide messages.
Susan's got a lot of titles. She's worked at Google, Sun Microsystems. She's written multiple books on cybersecurity. She is in the Cybersecurity Hall of Fame. These days, she's a cybersecurity policy professor at Worcester Polytechnic Institute in Massachusetts. And talking to noobs like me.
If we think about the amount of information we have online, and more importantly, how we control things online, we control the power grid online, we do banking online. We have our healthcare information online. Some of that information is private, but some of that information needs to be secured for the safety of individuals and the safety of society. And so encryption is as much about security as it is about privacy.
Okay, so how do we keep things secret online? There are a bunch of different types of encryption. They're different in the way they protect information, how they scramble and let you unscramble it. It's complicated. But Susan says the easiest way to think about this is a simple code. Here's a really basic one.
One way you do it, a system that's been around for thousands of years, is the Caesar shift. You take the alphabet and you shift it a few letters. So the shifting is what we call the algorithm, the method for encryption. How much you shift, whether you shift by two letters and A becomes a C, or three letters and A becomes a D, that amount of shift is called the key. And in cryptography, you let the algorithm be known, but you keep the key secret.
So the Caesar shift, moving the alphabet a few letters, is simple. But when you're sharing your credit card information, health files, or a personal email, the level of encryption gets a lot more complicated.
When you work in encryption and you work in security, you always think, how could somebody break this? You become either like a little kid or a snarky counterintelligence agency.
Sure.
If you're going to do good security, you have to think, well, how, you know, I know how this is going to work. How can it be broken? And if you don't think about how it can be broken, then you're not doing your job.
One of the things that's interesting about encryption is that it's this tool that constantly inspires people to find new ways to break it. So it's always being undermined. If it's always being undermined, should we do away with it?
You think it's fundamental to the modern world?
I don't see any way around it. It is the one tool that makes it hard when somebody takes a piece of information for them to actually understand what the information is about.
Susan Landau. She's an author and cybersecurity expert.
So I have Ben Johnson with me in the studio now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
Encryption is complicated, and as we hear in your kind of morning audio diary, it's everywhere. It seems like there's no way around it.
Yeah, I think that's kind of fair to say. When we have all of this information online and we need to trade it online and we have to have some level of privacy there, I think that we need to have ways to hide it. And encryption is a big part of that.
But as you demonstrated, there are kind of two different things going on. One is sort of in the background, built into these processes that we use in our everyday lives. And then the other is intentionally using encrypted ways of communicating. So
sure.
I put double-factor authentication on my email, and
yep.
I use the encrypted app Signal for texting.
Yeah. Well, why did you sign up for Signal?
I signed up for Signal in part in the wake of the election. I became very aware of, you know, hacking as a geopolitical thing when we saw the DNC hacks. And then I also think a lot about companies and the pressure they're often under by the U.S. government. So I am interested in something like Signal where the code is open source. And so, yeah, maybe that means that they are vulnerable to the same amount of hacking as someone else. But since it's open source, there are thousands of internet users out there who will recognize if there are nefarious things going on.
These people that are trying to break it.
Right.
Also,
yeah.
Right? We actually talked to the guy who built Signal. His name is Moxie Marlinspike. And he told us that after the election, they saw 400% growth in daily users every day for an extended period, which reflects, I think, that the regular user conversation around encryption is changing. So it's going away from not just the stuff that happens in the background, like HTTPS, that little padlock that you see in your screen that shows you that something's encrypted and you're protected. But now it's actually changed to people actually thinking about being actively engaged in using encryption on a daily basis. And that's important because it really does protect us as you like part of your reasoning was it was protecting you potentially from hacking and potentially surveillance.
So I'm a journalist. I think about this stuff as sort of a professional obligation. Maybe if someone is trying to contact me to keep that private or secret or what have you, why should my mother care?
You know, again, encryption is used all over the place. You heard this recent news about Yahoo announcing that over a billion Yahoo email accounts had been compromised. We actually talked to some password management companies soon after this, and one of them called Dashlane said it had a 40% spike in traffic to its site following the Yahoo attacks. Now, password managers kind of use encryption and give you these sort of master keys that help you manage all of your passwords for your sites more safely and more securely. And this is something that anyone who might use email or do anything online is probably using encryption in some way.
What about the argument that you do hear from people, which is, I'm not doing anything bad. I'm just, you know, talking to my friends, sending pictures of my grandkids. Why should I worry?
Yeah, it's a fair question. And I think that over time, the conversation has changed. So a lot of people maybe are feeling the need to protect their data following the election. And that's the spike that seems to be happening. It's also really important for activists. And this is a conversation that happens both abroad and at home. You know, a lot of the people who work in the security field, they would push back against this idea of like, I have nothing to hide, which is like, you may not have anything to hide now, but privacy is something that protects a lot of people who are doing good, not just people who are doing bad. And one activist here in the U.S., Malkia Cyril, thinks encryption is really important for activists. She's also the founder and executive director for the Center for Media Justice. And we talked to her on this episode of Codebreaker as well. And she thinks specifically Black Lives Matter activists really need to encrypt their data.
All right, let's listen to that.
The state's argument for accessing people's phones is usually to protect us from crime or terrorism. But lots of people think encryption is a tool to protect them from state surveillance. That's the perspective of Malkia Cyril. She's the executive director of the Center for Media Justice and a Black Lives Matter activist.
Throughout history, Black dissidents has been discouraged. Black dissidents has been criminalized. So today in the 21st century, at a time when Black voices are rising, Black people are saying that our lives have meaning, our futures matter. We want to see this country invest, right, in justice and freedom and in our ability to stay alive, you know, most basically. And under those conditions, Black dissidents must be protected. It's very clear to anybody who's paying any attention that the FBI of today is not very different from the FBI of the late 1960s, at least in its relationship to Black dissidents. It polices Black dissidents. It criminalizes Black dissidents. And so Black Lives Matter activists more than ever need to encrypt.
I totally get the logic of wanting to be able to protect people with the use of encryption, especially activists. It also seems possible that some of these tools can and are being used for the opposite, right? That are being used by, you know, racist groups
members of a surveillance state that wish to do harm to the activists that you really want the state to protect?
I mean, you know, some people think it's complicated. To me, it's pretty simple. The fact of the matter is, will bad actors use encryption to do bad acts? Possibly, but it's more important to protect liberty. It's more important to protect freedom. It's more important to stand by. You can't say you're a nation of laws and then violate the human and civil rights of your citizens. You know, that's sure. just not, that sure. just can't work. So yeah, it, you know, can we balance, do we need to balance security and privacy? Sure. But the reality is that has never been true for someone like me. That wasn't true for my mother. That wasn't true for her mother. And it won't be true for my child.
So, Ben, when I listen to her, I feel like she is zeroing in on a point that came up a lot after the San Bernardino shooting. The FBI wanted to access the assailant's phone.
Yep.
And Apple basically had a big fight with them over this. And so it's this idea of how much is encryption for our protection? How much is breaking encryption for our protection? And most importantly, who gets to make that call?
Yeah, it's really tricky. I mean, you know, when we have conversations about this and say, well, I'm not doing anything wrong, for instance, you know, Malkia has a really different perspective because she, I think, has seen a history mm-hmm. of how people have behaved towards her family and the people that she works with and the work that she does. And she thinks that it's really important for protecting liberty. And that's different from maybe another user.
So it seems like, you know, to wrap this up, the conversation that people need to be having now is not whether to use encryption, but about the encryption that is already happening in all of our lives, whether we realize it or not, and to what degree we want it and what degree we don't.
Yeah, and how to do it as individual users and how much we want to opt in. And I think we all have to think about that.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace's Codebreaker podcast and Marketplace Tech. Thank you.
Thank you, Lizzie.
Look, kids, Big Ben, Parliament. Yeah, okay. That is from the movie European Vacation. But Big Ben, officially called the Elizabeth Tower, is closing to tourists like the Griswold family in the movie. The London landmark is getting a $36 million facelift and starting in January will be covered in scaffolding for about 3 years. Its famous bells will also be silenced for 6 months. Big Ben's familiar face and bells will be missed, perhaps no place more than at the BBC, where it's heard and seen every day on radio and TV. From our partners there, Nicholas Stanbridge takes a last trip up the tower before the work starts.
Steve Jags is the keeper of the great clock.
You're now entering the Elizabeth Tower, climbing 334 steps to the belfry.
Soon to have a winter coat of scaffolding, a necessity from time to time, as described in Pathé Archive from 1955.
Among Parliament's many famous voices, only one is heard round the world year in and year out, that of Big Ben himself at the top of his great tower. So great a public figure requires careful grooming to keep him in trim, and that's a major task.
My guys, they have to climb here three times a week to do the clock winding. I'm sorry, let me have a breath back.
Where are we now?
We're behind what we call the south face of the Elizabeth Tower. It will be necessary to remove this lattice framework and remove the glass. And we are now sourcing a glass identical to this because this is no longer produced.
The clock tower was completed in 1859, designed by Sir Charles Barry and Augustus Pugin, after fire destroyed the old Palace of Westminster. At its heart, the mechanism room, where we pause next.
There is a pendulum swinging, so that tick that you hear in the background, which is very therapeutic when you're up here doing a time change late at night, it's a 2 second swing click. We adjust the speed of the clock to make it go faster or to make it go slower, by adding just one of the old decimal pennies to the pendulum. We like to keep this clock within 2 seconds of accuracy, and on New Year's night we are now working towards making this exactly accurate with the leap second. We're now coming up to the quarter past the hour chimes, with the wheels and the ironwork going round that go up to what we call the link room, and then they go up to the quarter bells upstairs. They will start moving. We've still got another quarter of the way to go to the actual bells. You're now in the belfry, and this is where Big Ben, the bell, hangs, with the four quarter bells actually wrapped around this wrought iron frame that supports 25 ton of bell weight. When the clock tower was first built and the bell was first commissioned, you could hear the bell as far away as Tower Bridge. That's just not possible today because obviously all the London traffic noise, more background noise in London, drowning it out.
Where is the microphone for Radio 4? Because we use it for the 6 o'clock news and the midnight news as well.
You do indeed. The microphone is actually above your head, probably about 15 foot above Big Ben itself. Four microphones actually connected to the roof structure.
We couldn't live without the sound for too long, could we?
No, we could not do without the sound. And one of the reasons why BBC actually recorded the sound and broadcast the sound to the world during the Second World War is to let our troops know abroad that London hadn't fallen. Gave them a reassuring noise of home.
You'll cry when you hear his song.
He was close to the hammer now as anybody has ever been to that hammer. In the motor room downstairs, the bit that actually makes all this work, the wheels are starting to move. Here we go. Very British, and it's a sound that we cannot do without. And we have deadlines that we have to meet. For example, Remembrance Sunday. We will also be sounding bells for New Year's Eve, because you can't have New Year's Eve without the sound of Big Ben.
That's the BBC's Nicola Stanbridge. And that's our show for this week. Next week, we'll be celebrating a new year. And in our show, we're going to talk about what we're long and short for 2017. Also, we'll look back on some of our favorite moments from the past year, including some of our favorite Marketplace quizzes. Don't forget to visit us at marketplace.org, on our Facebook page, or hit us up on Twitter. We're at MarketplaceWKND. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Haley Hirschman and Eliza Mills. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Ben Talladay is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Sitara Nieves is Marketplace's executive producer. Deborah Clark is our general manager. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. I hope your holidays are safe and full of joy. Thanks for listening. This is APM.